From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
China is home to the world's largest dam, the world's longest wall, and now the world's highest railroad. The Chinese government inaugurated the Qinghai to Tibet Railway about 6 months ago, and it claims the train will bring major new opportunities to Tibet. Critics say the project is a political move which threatens Tibet's culture and its environment. With me now for the second of today's underreported features are Thomas Laird, former correspondent for Asia Week, also the author of a new book called The Story of Tibet. And Lila Buckley joins us from Beijing. She's the Beijing correspondent for China Watch. I'm very pleased to welcome them to the show. And Lila, haven't you just returned from a trip on the train?
I have. I just returned yesterday morning from Lhasa to Beijing.
Well, actually, this connection is really impossible. I can hardly hear you. You say you returned from a trip from, you know, we'll try to call you back. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Lila. Thomas Laird, this railroad project has been praised as an engineering marvel. Is it?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about the feats that have been achieved here. I mean, they spent $3.2 billion, and it took 5 years. It was achieved, I think, 1 year. It was completed 1 year earlier. The technology is marvelous. It is an example of how great the Chinese nation is in expanding its reach over the world.
What did the Chinese government say it hoped to accomplish when they proposed the railroad?
Well, the Chinese government's viewpoint is that the railroad will dramatically contribute to the economic development of Tibet, and that they hope that the railway will help to knit the ethnic minorities of China into the Chinese nation.
Well, before the train, how did people travel from Beijing and elsewhere to in China to Tibet?
Well, in the 1980s, when I first went to Tibet, you traveled on a dirt road from Kathmandu to Lhasa, and when you left Lhasa going by land towards Beijing, 2,400 miles away, you also went on a dirt road. So
you had to go through Nepal?
No. When you went the other direction, I mean, there were roads from Lhasa down to Kathmandu, and there were roads from Lhasa to Beijing. Several roads: the Golmud Road, which goes out to Gansu, and then the other road, which goes to Sichuan. But these roads were dirt paved in a few places. They were very difficult roads right through the 80s and 1990s. And as soon as Tibet began to be open to Westerners, China was in the middle of a big development boom in China, in Tibet. And so they began to improve those roads dramatically throughout the 90s. And then we had the arrival of jet travel very quickly. Commercial jet travel, I think, began in the late 80s and early 90s. And then the railroad was an extension of this plan to develop Tibet.
Were environmental groups concerned when they learned of the plan to build this railway?
There are environmental concerns, and I think China has tried to address some of them. But it's clear that the railway will have a negative effect, for example, on the migration routes of some endangered species in Tibet.
Why is that?
Well, because you have these very long, some of the sheep, the blue sheep, some of the endangered sheep in Tibet migrate for thousands of miles to, I don't know the exact number, but for hundreds of miles at any rate, to reproduce in one valley. There's only one valley. George Schaller has done work on this. There's only one valley where they reproduce, where they give birth every year. And this railway line obstructs that, and there's fear that they might not be able to cross it, that it could obstruct things like that. And then, of course, there's the permafrost issue and a number of environmental concerns that the Chinese, of course, say they've addressed, but there's no way for independent observers to really confirm that.
We've gotten Lila Buckley back with us from Beijing. Lila, we were talking about your trip on the train, your recent trip on the train. Were you aware of these environmental issues while you were traveling?
Yes, I was. I actually work for an environmental NGO based in Beijing and was out in Lhasa for some work-related meetings. We're working on sustainable development issues there. And I've also done some research on some of the grassroots initiatives that happened around the building of the train. It's definitely quite an issue among the NGO community here.
Uh-huh. What did you see out of the windows while you were traveling?
A lot of nothingness. I was actually looking for signs of either the antelope or the various pilings, and it's a lot of vast, empty space. In the towns where the train stopped, there is a lot of trash. That's something I did notice that people had told me would be there. I didn't see any antelope, and I didn't see much of the highways. There is a major power line that goes alongside the train line. It's actually been there much longer than the train tracks have been in there. And the power line has had quite an impact as well, before the train thing was put in.
Did you go both ways on when you traveled on the train?
I actually flew in and then took the train back.
And how long did the trip take?
Just under 50 hours.
50 hours. Now,
mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if it's called the Qinghai to Tibet Railway, there are two different steps, aren't there? This new railroad is from Tibet, from Lhasa to Qinghai, and then there was already a railroad to Beijing?
Right. It's actually a direct line, but the Qinghai-Tibet part of it refers to the new section of the line that was there used to be a line that just went from Beijing to Qinghai, but now it connects Qinghai through to Lhasa.
When you were in the high altitudes, was that at all uncomfortable?
Well, I flew in, and I did have some altitude reaction, mild headache and sort of dizziness. Some of my colleagues had much more severe reactions and had to stay in bed for the first day or two that we were there. But on the train itself, because I'd been in Tibet actually over a week at that point, I didn't feel any more effects. I had already adjusted by then. But they provide oxygen tubes, and they have medical stations that they're setting up along the tracks for passengers.
Who was riding on the train with you?
I shared a cabin actually with five Tibetan students who were on their way to Xi'an for 2 weeks to present their thesis on Chinese studies, actually. But there was a mixture of mostly Han Chinese and Tibetan passengers. I only met one other foreigner in our section of the train.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. The line is still less than we would have hoped for. You would have thought with the all of the connections between China and the United States these days that we could have put together a better phone connection. But thank you so much for talking with us, Lila Buckley, who is the Beijing correspondent for China Watch. And we'll go back now to Thomas Laird, who is the former correspondent for Asia Week and the author of a new book called The Story of Tibet. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Thomas, who is traveling this train? Lila talked about Tibetans who were going into China, but who's going the other way?
Well, as Lila said, there's going to be very few foreigners on any train. From what we know from reports from people who've been on the train, The primary people you see on the train are Chinese tourists who are coming in to take their pictures and leave. And then the big downside to this whole train are the Chinese economic migrants.
So these are people who are looking for jobs.
Yes, exactly.
Is there that much work in Tibet?
Well, there wouldn't be if the Chinese government weren't offering immense billions of dollars, I mean, huge amounts of economic incentives for Han Chinese to move to Tibet.
And that is so that they can kind of make Tibet into less of a Tibetan country?
They're looking for, I mean, the railroad, the fear from the railroad is that it's going to be used as a demographic final solution to China's long problem with Tibet.
But wasn't a railway like this inevitable because China has fought so doggedly to hold on to Tibet?
Absolutely. I mean, China, you know, has shown for 50 years that it has every intention of holding on to Tibet. But the funny thing is that during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and even the 80s, China wasn't allowing Chinese people to move to Tibet. I mean, there was no attempt to encourage, and there was certainly no attempt to encourage Chinese to move to Tibet. There was every attempt to protect the Tibetan Autonomous Region as a distinct Tibetan homeland for the Tibetan people. There was a change in that after the 1980s and after Deng Xiaoping.
I read an interview with a Tibetan passenger on the train who said that although he's concerned about the job competition the train will bring, Tibet also needs to open up.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody wants, I think all Tibetans want to see economic development in Tibet, but the problem is that if you don't have genuine autonomy for the Tibetans, that the development will be used for, you know, the benefit of the Chinese people rather than the Tibetan nation. For example, you know, I was reading something recently with the Chinese minister for railways, and he said very frankly, and he was trying to use it as an example of how China was helping the Tibetans. He said that, well, look, you know, there's 25,000 workers on the railway. This was when they were building it, and 700 of them are Tibetan. Well, the numbers kind of tell a different story. I mean, those numbers from his own mouth are exactly the problem.
Will this train also be carrying import and export goods?
Yes, to a degree, absolutely. There are certainly things that will be cheaper. It will be cheaper to do export products from Tibet, such as herbal medicines, which are very popular in China now, and even I hear some water, some pure mineral water will be exported. But you can't really take a vast amount of, it's only one line. I mean, you can't take gigantic amounts. It's not going to contribute immensely to the economic development through freight. It will contribute some.
Now, is this going to have any effect on Tibet's nomadic peoples?
Well, that's the whole question. I mean, if you look at the history of China and Tibet, around, and not just with this railway, but going back for the last couple thousand years, there's been a battle between the Chinese farmers and the nomads of the high plains going on for thousands of years. And in the past, before the advent of advanced technologies, before gunpowder, you know, the nomads had the upper hand over the farmers, and that's why the Chinese built the Great Wall, was to keep the nomads out, you know, from attacking the farmers. But now, since the 19th century, the farmers of China have taken the upper hand with all the nomads. And what China always tries to do, whether it's in Inner Mongolia or in Xinjiang during the past 100 years, what China always tries to do is to prevent people from being nomads. I mean, during the Cultural Revolution, people were, you know, encouraged to give up their herds and to become farmers. And in Xinjiang, nomads are encouraged to become farmers and to quit being nomads. There's been a big move because China fears nomads. So when you look at this railroad in context of China's long fight to stop the nomad invaders of China threatening the farmers of China, then you do have to wonder if that isn't part of the intent here is to get rid of animal husbandry, nomadism, as a form of survival, because that's where the threat to the Chinese farmers have always come for thousands of years.
And is it simply the Chinese government simply opposed to nomadic people because they are a threat to farmers or because it's hard to control nomadic people?
Exactly. If you know Lattimore's view of the history of Inner Asia, Owen Lattimore, his view is that the Great Wall was a line between two worlds. Those on the plains who herded animals where you couldn't really farm, they were never Chinese. They never adopted Chinese characters. They never lived within Chinese cities. They were always in opposition to the farmers. So that's a deeply ingrained thing. And remember, the nomads of Inner Asia butchered hundreds of millions of Chinese during the Mongol invasions, during the Manchu invasions. I mean, the Chinese soul has been scarred by its conflict with the Inner Asian nomads for millennia. This isn't something that goes away in a couple of hundred years.
Is this railroad vulnerable to terror attacks?
Well, if there were any such terrorists in China, but there are not.
Well, there has been tension in Western China, hasn't there?
Very disorganized, very small. I mean, you know, large firecrackers. I mean, really, this is an excuse for the Chinese to use force to settle the question with their ethnic minorities rather than to use open dialogue. And that's all any of the ethnic minorities are asking for is, look, you know, we just don't want you coming in here with hundreds of millions of Chinese and settling our land and taking it away from us, you know, without at least talking. I mean, giving it, they're asking for a democratic place at the table, and the Chinese are refusing that.
Have you spoken to the Dalai Lama about the railroad?
I haven't, but I do follow. I mean, I did 50 hours of interviews with him for, you know, the Story of Tibet, Conversations with the Dalai Lama, which is in bookstores now. But I do follow what he says very carefully, and looking at his public statements over the past few months, what I hear him saying, if I could summarize his feelings, it would be something like this. He says that the railway itself is not inherently bad, and that everyone wants to have economic development for themselves and their loved ones. So that's natural. But clearly the Dalai Lama wants a better life for the Tibetan people economically. And so it's exactly for these reasons that he says that it's within the Tibetan people's economic interest to be part of the People's Republic of China. But at the same time, he says, as I understand it, the other side of the coin is that in the absence of safeguards like genuine autonomy for the Tibetan people, which is guaranteed by the Chinese constitution, which is not being given, that the railroad and all economic development projects in Tibet have a great potential to do harm. That's the problem. It's not the railway itself. It's what's going to be done with it. If China were seriously intending the economic development of Tibet with this, you know, if that was their primary reason for doing this, then they wouldn't have brought any Chinese in to work on that railroad. They would have done it all with Tibetan labor, but they didn't do that.
Thomas Laird is former correspondent for Asia Week, the author of The Story of Tibet, and that's now in bookstores, as he says. And I want to thank you so much for participating in today's Underreported.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.